Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
If you were sitting in the trial of Karen Reed today, May 21st of 2025, you probably wouldn't have guessed the day would open with a mystery that had nothing to do with Karen Reed or John O'Keefe. Well, I mean, it had to do with the trial, but the first thing Judge Cannone did wasn't call a witness or address the jury. It was to clear the courtroom. And just like that, everyone was out. Something was up with the jury. No one knew what, and instead of airing it publicly, Cannone brought each juror up to the sidebar, one by one, behind closed lips and furrowed brows, to get to the bottom of whatever had sparked concern. She wasn't taking any chances. What we do know is this. No juror admitted to breaking any rules. Nobody confessed to discussing the case, being approached, or peeking at headlines they weren't supposed to see. And yet Cannone felt the need to remind them forcefully not to talk about the case, not to each other, not to their spouses, not to their dogs. Her tone from the account inside made it clear. This trial is not going off the rails on her watch. So after that quiet storm of closed-door questions, court resumed. No damage done. At least not from the jurors. And then walked in Dr. Azik Wolf. Yes, Dr. Azik Wolf. We're going to talk about what he talked about in just a second. But first, if you're new here, be sure to press subscribe wherever it is you're watching us, whether it's YouTube, Twitter, X, wherever it may be, or listening to us on whatever podcast platform you have found us on. Hit subscribe. And be sure to check out our platforms back and forth, whether you want the podcast or on YouTube or social. It's all over there. Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Just search it wherever you are looking. All right. Dr. Azik Wolf. Oh, and this too. Comments. Tell me what you think about how all this went today. I'm really looking forward to seeing that. So if you're thinking Dr. Wolf, it sounds like a character out of a medical drama, right? Today he played the part to perfection. He wasn't originally scheduled for today, but the prosecution moved him up, calling him out of order. He's a neurosurgeon from Miami, not your everyday brain doc. This is a guy who lives inside skulls, and he came to court with a very clear, very clinical explanation of how John O'Keefe died, and more importantly, how he didn't. Would you like to learn about that, kids? According to Dr. Wolf, the injuries that killed Boston police officer John O'Keefe didn't come from a bat or a hammer or any kind of weapon at all. They came from the ground. He told the jury that O'Keefe's skull showed a specific kind of trauma, a linear fracture, not a depressed one. In layman's terms, here's the difference. A depressed fracture is what happens when something like your head or something hits your head, like a hammer or a bat. A linear fracture, the kind O'Keefe had, is more what happens when your head hits something else, like concrete. Wolf explained that to get the type of injury seen in this case, O'Keefe would have had to fall backwards, hit the back of his head hard, and suffer an internal cascade that ultimately killed him. Now, it's important to understand how specific that analysis is. Wolf wasn't just guessing based on bruises. He's walked the jury through the photos and the autopsy, and if you're squeamish like I am, you gotta kind of take a break because it's very detailed and kind of gory, showing the base of the skull, the contusions on the brain, and what's known as in neurosurgical circles as raccoon eyes. If you've ever heard of that, raccoon eyes are bruises around the eyes caused by internal bleeding from a skull base fracture. They're not the result of someone punching you in the face. They're a sign of something much deeper, much more severe happening inside of the head. And here's where it got especially important. Wolf testified that raccoon eyes don't show up right away. They take time, 1 to 3 hours after the injury. It's a big deal because it suggests that O'Keefe didn't die instantly. He was alive for some time after the head trauma. If that trauma happened hours before he was found, it throws a wrench into several assumptions about when and where he sustained the fatal injury. Wolf went further. He explained that O'Keefe likely lost consciousness quickly after the fall, but his body didn't shut down right away. He believes hypothermia could have played a role in prolonging O'Keefe's life, his core temperature dropping so low that it delayed the biological process that would have otherwise killed him faster. It's cold comfort, literally, but it adds a layer of complexity to the timeline. And he might have had a chance, should someone have called. Not great chances, but a chance, if he wasn't just lying there in the snow. The one thing to look at in this case is he was likely very unconscious. So he wasn't aware that he was unable to move lying in the snow. Remember, this is a murder trial. The prosecution's theory is that Karen Reed backed her SUV into O'Keefe, hit him with the vehicle, and left him in the snow to die. The defense obviously disputes that entirely, and what Dr. Wolf offered today was something in between, a scientifically grounded explanation for the injuries without pointing fingers. He didn't say Karen Reed did it. He didn't say someone else did. What he did say was that the cause of death, blunt force trauma from a fall, doesn't match what you'd expect from a beating. And that's where things got a little more spicy. On cross, defense attorney Robert Alessi came in with a scalpel of his own. He pressed Wolf, asking if he had any forensic pathology training, because after all, determining cause of death is usually the job of a pathologist, not a surgeon. Wolf did not flinch. He didn't blink. He stared right ahead and even kind of chuckled at him. I'm not a forensic pathologist. I'm a brain surgeon. Then added, as if he almost rehearsed it, I see more brains than a forensic pathologist. Woo! Mic drop! You could hear a pin drop in that courtroom. Alessi, though, wasn't done, because he's never done. Just keep digging. Dig, dig, dig. Y'all been hanging around Karen Reed too much. He brought up a laceration found on O'Keefe's eyelid. Could that have been caused by the fall? Wolf said no. It didn't come from the internal injury. That eyelid cut had to come from something external. And that was as far as it went. The cross was short, sharp, didn't rattle the witness. If anything, Wolf came out stronger. So what we're left with is a moment in the trial where science walked in and complicated the narrative for the defense. No big dramatics, no emotional breakdowns, just a man with decades of medical experience saying, here's how this happened. And here's how it didn't. Whether that lands with the jury the way it did with the gallery, calm, confident, and precise, is another matter. But today's session didn't end with Wolf. After lunch, the court shifted gears into the fine-grained details of forensic debris. That's where the puzzle pieces come out of. Glass, the plastic, and the question of how much of a shattered taillight can really tell us about the death in the snow. When Dr. Wolf stepped down from the witness stand, having offered his medically grounded account of how John O'Keefe likely died, the courtroom shifted from skull fractures and brain swelling to something far more smaller, these very fragments, these shards, these slivers of plastic and glass, the kind of evidence that doesn't shout, but it whispers. And those whispers came from forensic trace expert Christina Hanley. Hanley took to the stand as a scientist with the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab. Her specialty isn't blood or DNA, it's debris. Trace evidence, the microscopic world that clings to clothing, embeds in bumpers, and hides in the corners of crime scenes. She doesn't work with certainties so much as she works with consistencies. That might sound like a soft kind of science, but when handled carefully, trace evidence can paint a detailed picture, if not a very sharp one, at least a textured one. The prosecution brought her in to talk about what was found on John O'Keefe's clothes and what was found on Karen Reed's Lexus. Because if you believe the state's case, the story is that Reed backed into O'Keefe with her SUV, causing injuries that led to his death and leaving him to die in the snow. After that happened, you'd expect to find some trace of that impact on him, on the car, or ideally both. Hanley started with what was recovered from O'Keefe's clothing. She examined the items collected from the scene, and what she found were tiny plastic fragments, clear and red. Some were barely visible. One no larger than a grain of rice. These weren't chunks you could pick up and hold between your fingers. It was a splinter-level material, the kind you'd find if something brittle, like a taillight, in the cold, broke on impact and scattered underfoot. Her analysis showed that these fragments were chemically and visually consistent with the type of plastic used in the Lexus SUV taillight assemblies. Specifically, the same type of Lexus that Karen Reed drives. Oh, go figure that. But, and this is critical, Hanley made it clear that she could not say with certainty that the plastic came from Reed's car. It was indistinguishable, yes, but not unique. In other words, it matched. But it wasn't a fingerprint, because it's on every Lexus out there. It could have come from Reed's Lexus, or from another taillight, from the same make and model, which just happened to be there at that moment in time, right? And missing a taillight. Or theoretically from another object made with the same composite plastic. That might sound like a very much splitting of the hairs, but in the courtroom, consistent with and from are worlds apart. Still, for the prosecution, the implication, it was powerful. If O'Keefe had red plastic on his clothes that matches the shattered Lexus taillight, and Reed's Lexus had a broken taillight that night, you start to get the contour of their argument. That her SUV made contact with them. The defense, of course, has its own angle, because why not? Maybe the fragments got there some other way. Maybe they aren't from her car at all. That's where the limits of forensic trace evidence leave the room for interpretation. You know, microscopic pieces being implanted in the conspiracy, I guess, is what they're going for. Hanley didn't stop at plastic. She also testified about shards of glass found near where O'Keefe's body was, in fact, discovered. Outside 34 Fairview Road in Canton, investigators collected 9 fragments of clear glass from the area. And when Hanley examined them, she found something interesting. 6 of the 9 shards actually fit together, not just in a general way. They clicked into place like a jigsaw puzzle. And what they formed was a partial reconstruction of a drinking glass, specifically a cocktail glass that was also recovered at the scene, broken near where O'Keefe had been lying. That detail matters because it supports the idea that the glass shattered in that spot, likely as part of whatever event led to O'Keefe being left outside. O'Keefe being, obviously, the man who lost his life. Hanley's reconstruction in its quiet precision helped anchor the physical context of the scene. There wasn't just broken glass at the location. There was broken glass that matched a specific object found at that very spot. No one had to guess where the glass had been, whether it had been planted or brought in from elsewhere. The fragments told their own story. They had always belonged to that broken cocktail glass. There's more, though. Hanley was asked about what was found on Reed's Lexus SUV, specifically her rear bumper. Several tiny fragments were collected during the examination of the vehicle. 2 larger pieces were analyzed and turned out to be clear glass, but here's where the trail got a little muddy. Those 2 glass pieces did not match the broken cocktail glass found at the scene. They weren't part of the same object. What that means, well, not much conclusively, just that Reed's bumper had glass on it from some other source. Then there were the 3 additional glass particles found on the bumper. Hanley told the jury that these pieces were so small, so degraded, that she couldn't analyze them further. They were, for all forensic purposes, useless. No conclusions could be drawn about their origin. They were marked, logged, and left as exactly that, inconclusive. Under cross-examination, the defense went straight for the soft spots in Hanley's testimony. Robert Alessi, representing Karen Reed, zeroed in on the limitations. Could she say the plastic came from Reed's car? No, only that it was consistent. Could she say the unmatched glass on the Lexus came from the same scene? No. And the three particles that couldn't be analyzed? Well, they were just fragments with no voice. Alessi's goal here isn't to discredit Hanley personally. She came across as measured, competent, and very deliberate. But he wanted the jury to see the difference between scientific suggestion and scientific certainty. And that's really what today boiled down to. How far you can go with consistency. Trace evidence, by nature, doesn't often hand you a smoking gun. It gives you smoke patterns. Residual trails, threads that may or may not tie together. The state's case isn't being built on one conclusive piece. It's more like a mosaic. Plastic here, glass there, blood evidence elsewhere, each witness laying a tile. Hanley tiles were small, but they were not insignificant. She was calm under questioning. She made no leaps, no overstatements. When she couldn't say something definitively, she said so. That may seem cautious, but in a trial like that, caution reads as credibility. The jury listened closely. They didn't need scientists. Hanley walked them through the logic step by step, never overselling the point, but making sure they understood what her work showed and what it didn't. What stuck more than anything was a contrast. Plastic that matched, but could it be confirmed? Glass that fit like a puzzle, but didn't connect across the board. It was a day of near certainties and forensic nudges. Whether that's enough to sway a jury or just enough to make them ask better questions remains to be seen. What did you think of everything today? Was it groundbreaking? Was it bombshell testimony? I would say from the, if I were to pick one, I would go with Dr. Wolf early in the day. But the afternoon was, pretty consistent too. Microscopic pieces, not usually super even visible to the naked. That doesn't just happen. Well, it was planted. That would be an interesting one. And I just don't buy it. Follow the science, they say. Well, there's some science. Tell me in the comments what you think about what went on today. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening to this or watching this. Be sure to check us out on YouTube if you really want to comment or on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski on YouTube to find us there or wherever you get podcasts. My name is Tony Brewski. We will talk again real soon.
Want true crime coverage all day, every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.